This week on Art of the Air features veteran journalist and author Todd S. Purdom discussing his over 40-year career and his new book about Desi Arnaz. Next, Bronx-born cultural leader Melanie Capote, executive director of the Caribbean Cultural Center of African Diaspora. Our spotlights on Dance On, Evenings of Dance and Music in downtown Miller Beach on Lake Street all summer.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. And we'd like to welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight from the Miller Beach, and it's called Dance On Lake Street, Evenings of Dance and Music in downtown Miller Beach. And it started in June 25th and will be running through September 10th, and there'll be a whole bunch of different types of dances there. We have Julia Gibbs, who's going to tell us all about that and tell us what's going on. Julia, welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's nice seeing you, Julia.
So great. I'm very excited about this series. This is something that I started last year as a pilot program, because I really wanted to bring activity to Lake Street in Miller Beach. And it really took off last year. We just had a couple of sessions, but people responded really well to it. So this year we've been able to bring back this series as a whole set of dance sessions over the entire summer from June through September, as you mentioned.
So what can you people expect for this? I mean, what types of dance?
So we've got a couple of instructors coming in to do a lot of fun stuff. It's social dance, so salsa, bachata, cumbia, West Coast swing. Both couples and singles are welcome to come out. You don't have to have any experience at all. It's for people who do know how to dance and people who feel like they have two left feet. So we're going to have a whole bunch of different styles, as well as the dance instruction. We have two nights of just free dance with the DJ, including a night of blues and a night of music from the 80s.
So what types of crowds do you usually have?
For this in particular, this is a new series, so I guess we'll find out.
Well, what, last year, because obviously
last year we had, you know, maybe between 10 and 20 couples come out to dance.
Nice.
Yeah, it was really quite nice. I think one of the fun things about this series this year is that we're moving around Lake Street. I think many people know Lake Street as the business district of Miller Beach, and we've got a number of different restaurants and shops here, as well as the Marshall J. Gardner Center for the Arts. So I partnered with a couple other places to hold these. We're going to have some sessions in the gallery in our event space, and other ones will be on Tiny's Coffee Bar's patio. And then we'll also be at the Nelson Algren Museum 616 soundstage. So we'll be moving around all summer long. And all the events are listed on our website. So if people want to find out more about where they are, the particular styles of dance and when they're going to be, they're all going to be listed with our events.
Well, go ahead and tell us what some of the styles that are going to be available.
Well, we have an instructor named Carlos Martinez who teaches a number of different styles of Latin dance. So we're starting off with salsa, which I think a lot of people are familiar with. You know, salsa can be done by all ages. It can be a really simple dance, and it can be this very elegant, complicated dance. So you get to start with the basics. He comes in and he does about a 45-minute lesson where you learn how to do the basic moves, do turns, do some swings. We play music. It's a blast, really. So some of the others, bachata and cumbia, they're actually like a little bit simpler in terms of the stylistic aspects of the dance. So those are easy for people to pick up right away. So that one's a great one for beginners. And then West Coast Swing, I think probably people will be really familiar with this as a kind of style that you might see people dressed in vintage clothing doing those kind of lifts and spins. But again, we'll start out with the basics. And that class is being taught by Patty Kolvek from Dance Sophisticates. Ah. And she's been kind enough to come up and do a session for us over the summer, too.
Yeah, she's a local favorite for sure.
Yeah.
Is there a fee for doing this?
Yeah, it's $5 a person. And each night is about a two-hour session. So it's from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. And we're in locations where, for instance, at Tiny's Coffee Bar, they've got a whole dinner menu and they've got a bar where people can get cocktails, things like that. The 616 stage and the gallery will offer soft drinks, things like that for people to have a little refreshment because it does get a little hot. For some people who aren't so comfortable dancing outside, the gallery sessions are inside in the air conditioning. So there's a little bit of something for everyone.
So do you have anything else going on in Miller after the dance thing? I know you're connected with the whole arts district there, but you know, I know recently the area artist had an exhibit that I had some pieces in, but I mean, what a few other things besides dance going on?
We have a lot of things going on. Right now, we just opened a new exhibit in the gallery by an artist painter named Karen Azarnia. She's a painting instructor at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. And she has a solo show here through July 16th of really beautiful foliage and flowers of nature. And we're actually going to be open a special day because the Miller Beach Garden Walk happens at the end of June, the 28th and 29th. We'll be open for all of that Sunday so that people coming off the walk can come into the gallery and see Karen's work. I think it's a really nice opportunity.
The farmer's market also started last week, maybe?
It did. It started June 1st, and we'll be rolling through every Sunday through September. We have a few Sundays that we won't have markets, 4th of July and during the Gary Air Show, just because it's a little bit loud. Right. But I would like to call out, acknowledge our sponsors for this event for Dance On before we finish up. The Legacy Foundation was very generous in helping us put this series on, as well as my co-conspirator, a local named Diane Kanya, who's been great in helping me get this planned and has sponsored some of the DJ nights as well.
Real quick, your website and how to find out more information.
We are at millerbeacharts.org, or you can find us on Facebook at Miller Beach Arts, or give a call to 219-885-9114.
And that's Julia Gibbs from the Dance on Lake Street. Thank you so much for coming on Art on the Air Spotlight.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That was fantastic.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Sunday is brought to you by Emberforge Consulting, thoughtful marketing and digital learning built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com.
This is Peter Marks, former theater critic of the Washington Post, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
We are happy to welcome Todd S. Purdom to Art on the Air. Todd is a journalist and author. In a career of more than 40 years, he has written widely about politics and culture. Starting at the New York Times, he spent 23 years covering politics from City Hall to the White House, then later serving as a diplomatic correspondent and Los Angeles bureau chief. He has also been a staff writer at Vanity Fair, Politico, and The Atlantic. As an author, he has written Something Wonderful, Rodgers and Hammerstein's Broadway Revolution, and An Idea Whose Time Has Come, Two Presidents, Two Parties, and The Battle for the Civil Rights Act of 1964. His newest offering is Desi Arnaz, The Man Who Invented Television, an illuminating biography of the visionary, trailblazing Cuban-American who revolutionized television and brought laughter to millions as Lucille Ball's beloved husband on I Love Lucy, leaving a remarkable legacy that continues to influence American culture today. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Todd. It's very nice meeting you.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we always like our people, our audience, to know all about the people we have on our show. I call it your origin story. So tell us how Todd got from where you are to where you are now.
Well, I grew up in Macomb, Illinois, about 150 miles straight west of Indianapolis, a farm town where my family had lived for more than 150 years in the same county. I went east to school, to boarding school in New Hampshire, and then to college at Princeton in New Jersey. And I started working there as a student journalist. In my senior year, I was the campus stringer for the New York Times. And when I graduated from college, I took a job there as a copy boy, which is a glorified errand boy that doesn't really exist anymore in journalism to the degree that journalism itself exists still. But for 2 years, 2 months, and 29 days, I was something less than a reporter, and then got promoted to a trainee job and had the usual stations of the cross for a young reporter. Covered the cops, city hall, state and local politics, ultimately went to Washington, covered regional politics there, and then the White House, and spent 23 years there, as you noted. And so for more than 40 years, I've been writing mostly about politics, but whenever I could in my spare time, I've also scratched the itch that I've always had about popular culture. And that manifested itself in my book about Rodgers and Hammerstein, and most recently in the book about Desi, who was, you know, a part of my childhood in reruns of I Love Lucy and syndication. And I grew up, on those shows like everyone else did. And I thought in 2020, when I first began to pursue this idea, we were at a moment in our culture when people's lives were being reexamined, people whose contributions to our national life might have been somewhat under-celebrated in their own day. And it struck me that Desi would be a good topic for that. And I'm delighted that it all turned out.
Well, you know, I want to take you back even further, like life in Macomb in elementary school. So was the family political or writing? What was the household like?
My mother was involved in politics. She was the county Republican chairwoman. Her father had been before her, and she was active in political campaigns, not as a candidate herself, but working for others. My father and his father ran the local savings and loan, which was very much like the Bailey Brothers building and loan in It's a Wonderful Life. And going home at Christmas time to Macomb was quite a lot like going home to Bedford Falls, really. And you knew everybody in town and everybody knew you. And my father's older brother was an actor in New York. And when I was a child, my parents would go visit him and they'd come back after a week in New York, having seen 8 Broadway shows. And so my sister and I fell in love with the soundtrack albums of, the Broadway musicals of The Last of the Golden Era in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And so that was always a part of my life growing up, too. We would go to St. Louis, to the Municipal Opera, Chicago, to see traveling national companies of shows. We'd go to St. Louis for baseball games, too. So that was always a part of my life, along with, you know, interest in politics and current affairs. I was kind of a history nerd from an early age, growing up where I did. It's Illinois is the land of Lincoln, and we were 50 miles from Galesburg, which was Carl Sandburg's hometown, and 80 miles from Springfield, where Lincoln lived. Lincoln spent 2 nights in my hometown during the Senate campaign of 1858. In fact, because of the Great Chicago Fire, there are no buildings left in Chicago where Abraham Lincoln ever spent the night, and he spent 2 nights in my hometown. So I'm very proud of that.
Did you have any early notions of writing, you know, like did teachers spot like a skill in writing or, you know, where did that evolve from?
I always liked writing. I was the editor of my 6th grade newspaper, but I didn't have any notion that you could make a living as a writer. So I think I always grew up thinking I would be a lawyer, which seemed like a way to deal with words and get paid for it. But when I was in 8th grade, I won a couple of, like the American Legion citizenship contests and some DAR history award. And the president of the local bank, who whose family had owned the bank for generations, she would send out little clippings of from the newspaper if you made the paper. And she wrote a note saying, do you want to be a writer? It would seem you could be. And that's actually the first time it ever occurred to me that I could possibly be a writer. So even now, I think of myself as a journalist, which is kind of a low rent writer. Then it's sort of hard for me to think of myself as a writer, even though it's what I've been doing for the past 43 years. But no, the answer is I didn't really, it wasn't in my, you know, ken really in small town that that could be something I could do.
So approaching, you know, you're doing a journalism approach things versus a book. Tell us about that process. I mean, you know, writing a book is a much, you know, a lot of times there are things that are on a deadline for a journalist. And of course, a lot of the stuff is political, which generally has to be done quickly. But compare and contrast those writing things.
Yes. When I left the New York Times in 2006 to go to Vanity Fair and started writing full time for magazines, it was a very satisfying change because so much of journalism, as you say, is on deadline. It's very compressed. The inverted pyramid style in which you cram everything of importance in the top of the story is a very unnatural way of telling a story. I mean, nobody would say three travelers bound for the Emerald City were stopped by a wicked witch today. You would say, you know, a long time ago, I was walking down the yellow brick road. So to be able to tell the story, tell a story the way you would around a dinner table or a campfire or in the natural way that narration has happened for, you know, millennia was fun. And one of the great joys and challenges of writing nonfiction books is that we know now how the story came out. We know that I Love Lucy became an iconic program of early television and is still enjoyed. At the time, that they just were doing the best they could to have a job. And, you know, Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz saved their marriage and worked together. And nobody knew that this was going to become a legend. So it's fun to have the challenge of taking your reader back to the moment when the story was in formation and nobody knew exactly how it was going to come out. That's been one of the most satisfying things about writing books for me.
And before we move on to the book itself, I wanted to get your commentary maybe on journalism today, print journalism, how it's changing and everything since you've had such a storied career in the various things that you've done with the Vanity Fair, but also the New York Times and everything.
Well, one of the really sad realities, Larry, is that, you know, so many journalistic institutions are dying off for lack of support. You know, the internet changed radically how it all works, and the generations long model of advertising and subscription revenue combined to support the work of journalism has changed very much. And, you know, all across the country, medium sized markets are losing their newspapers or losing the print newspapers. Certainly state capitals are losing coverage of vital government, you know, activities. And opportunities for journalists to do their jobs are, you know, shrinking. I forget what the exact figures are, but, you know, it's practically a weekly or a monthly situation, which multiple outlets close or shrink. So, you know, I didn't realize I was coming into journalism in the early 1980s at the tail end of what turned out to be a sort of golden age for American journalism, but it was.
So with Vanity Fair or Political or The Atlantic, what is the percentage of, are you given what you are to write about or do you get to have input in that? And is that still the model today generally with?
With newspapers, if you're covering a beat like City Hall or the White House or the state legislature or the fire department or city council, usually the stories flood over you and it's a challenge to keep up with the pace of, you know, just simply what's happening and covering the activities of your beat. In magazine work, it was always a mix of ideas that I tried to generate and ideas that my editors came up with. And I found that the best thing you could do was actually, you know, make sure that your editor, if it was your idea, you wanted to make really sure that your editor was equally committed to it. Because in a monthly magazine, especially, too many things can happen between the time you come up with the idea and the time that actually gets into print because the lead time is very, very long. So you want to make sure that if your editor is not 100% enthusiastic on the day you get the assignment, the odds are high that he might be less enthusiastic by the time it comes around to put the piece in the magazine. So I would say it's a mix, but I've always very much liked the give and take, and I've craved the collaboration of colleagues and editors for coming up with ideas, because I certainly don't think I have any corner on the market of good ideas. And when one of the things that, you know, is the hardest challenge in coming up with a 10,000 word magazine piece in particular is making sure that you have a good idea that can be sustained at that length, and that will be readable 6 months or 8 months or 18 months from now in your doctor's office or your mother-in-law's house or wherever you happen to find the magazine.
I know, that's so true. Well, I want to say, you know, I've been watching the press on your book, and I have to say, like, Lucy Arnaz is so impressed with your book. So it's been delightful to have a family member have such high praise for it. So how did you choose Desi out of all the people you could have chosen to write about?
Well, I couldn't have written the book without Lucy's unstinting support. She didn't ever want any control over the manuscript, but she gave me carte blanche to her family archive. And she's just been making a friendship with her has been one of the wonderful gifts of writing the book, and the trust she showed in me, and also her realization that while her parents belong to the world, and she knows that they do, she's very clear-eyed about their human failings as, you know, mother and father, as any of us would be about our parents. So she's both protective of their legacy, and she's willing to have the story told, warts and all. And that was a great gift as a writer, to have somebody repose that amount of trust in you. In terms of coming up with the idea in 2020, speaking of shrinking journalism, I was involuntarily relieved of my job at The Atlantic during a pandemic. So I lost my job as a journalist, and I was looking for a project. And a college friend, the late actor and director, Doug McGrath, who's a wonderful guy, who actually died too young of a heart attack while he was in an off-Broadway one-man show being directed by John Lithgow about Doug's life growing up in Texas. He had always loved I Love Lucy, and he always thought Desi had gotten short shrift as the engine behind getting the show on the air and the kind of business brains behind the Desilu television empire. And he suggested that I pursue that. So I reached out to Lucy, who was very sympathetic, but at that time she was tied up in the project with Amazon and Aaron Sorkin about the movie that became Being the Ricardos. And she felt constrained from cooperating with any other project. So it took a little while for things to gel, but ultimately she opened her archive to me, invited me out to her house in Palm Springs. And with what I found there, combined with what I had seen in the Library of Congress, where there are about 80 some family scrapbooks of letters and clippings and materials, it was clear that there was enough material to tell Desi's story with a fresh perspective. And I'm just so grateful that 5 years later, this has all worked out.
Well, give us a thumbnail of the book and what it talks about. And especially, you know, you said the subtitle is like The Man Who Invented Television. And I understand it coming from kind of a theatrical and background, but what does that mean? How did Desi actually do that with his background in creating television as we know it today?
Yes, obviously, Larry, it's a kind of an overstatement. I stole it from an episode of NPR's Planet Money, which referred to Desi as the man who invented television. He was raised in Santiago de Cuba, the second largest city in Cuba, where his father had been the mayor. He was from a very wealthy aristocratic family. His mother's father was an executive at the Bacardi Rum Company. But they lost everything in the 1933 Cuban Revolution when the American-backed regime of Gerardo Machado was overthrown. So Desi wound up in Miami, penniless, and he became a self-taught musician and was ultimately spotted by the Latin bandleader Xavier Cugat, who was known as the king of the rumba. Desi helped popularize the conga dance craze in the late 1930s in nightclubs in Miami and New York. And then he got cast in a Broadway show by Rodgers and Hart, the great songwriting team of the 20s and 30s. And when he came west to Hollywood to make the movie version of that show, which was called Too Many Girls, the star was Lucille Ball, and they met. And although they were each dating other people, they broke up with their boyfriends and girlfriends and got eloped within 6 months. And as the 1940s ended, Lucy's career in the movies had kind of stalled out. Desi was on the road with his Latin band, and they had been married for 10 years, but had a hard time being together and wanted to have a family. They had never managed to have children yet. And Lucy had a successful radio show called My Favorite Husband on CBS in the last days of network radio. When CBS wanted to transfer the show to television, Lucy only wanted to do it if Desi could be her co-star. And the network and the sponsors were very, very reluctant at the idea of this thick-accented Cuban guy being the husband of an all-American girl, even though they were married in real life. So Desi came up with the idea of taking them on a vaudeville tour around the country to big movie theaters where they would do a live act with music and comedy. And one thing led to another, and CBS took a flyer on the show, and it promptly became a huge hit, and for most of the 1950s, was the number one show on television. And Desi Arnaz had the foresight to use that success then to build an empire that ultimately led to Desi Lu, the company they created, being the landlord or producer of all sorts of other shows, including those of Dick Van Dyke and Andy Griffith, Danny Thomas. And along the way, he came up with a lot of innovative techniques for making television, principally the decision to film I Love Lucy, you know, with three cameras in sync on 35 millimeter film, which is the main reason it's preserved today and looks as fresh as it ever did. And we're still laughing at it all these years later.
Because the preservation technique for that time was kinescope, which basically
was terrible. You couldn't do anything to make it better. There was no videotape yet. And
yeah, that was Bing Crosby's big thing. It's a videotape development. That's a whole story in itself. Well, you know, at this point, and of course, you know, we talked about the three camera shoot like you just did, which was actually used to this day in it. But let's take some expert, you know, excerpt from the book and maybe read something to us about it.
Here's just a little passage from the prologue that tries to put in perspective what Desi did. In the nearly 75 years since I Love Lucy debuted, it has been shown in more than 80 countries, dubbed into more than 20 languages, and seen by more than a billion people. In the 1980s, TV Guide judged that Lucille Ball's face had been seen more often by more people than the face of any human who ever lived. At the beginning of the 21st century, an episode of the show was playing every hour of every day somewhere in the world. Its characters are as familiar as our own families, and their images appear on lunchboxes, salt and pepper shakers, tea towels, pajamas, clocks, Christmas ornaments, and the postage stamps of multiple countries. On movie and television locations to this day, the doors of the honey wagons, the portable toilet trailers provided for the actors and crew, are not labeled men and women, but Desi and Lucy, and no one has the slightest doubt what they mean. The singular genius of Lucille Ball has everything to do with that, of course, but so does the singular vision of Desi Arnaz. Because he was an outsider and a disruptor, he asked questions that people weren't asking and therefore changed the way we make TV, said Amy Poehler, who directed the 2022 documentary film Lucy and Desi. And the way we make TV is very similar to how Desi first shaped it. Both he and Lucy did not look like the faces of gatekeepers in the 1950s. His story is often, at best, minimized, and at worst, like he was lucky to be on the show. And he made the show. How he did so is as good a story as any he ever produced, but it takes some splaining.
I love that. That's a great way to do it. It's a very readable book. I know we had the PDF electronic copy. Actually, that's how I like to read books anymore. I loved books, but I couldn't put it down sometimes. I was there and had television on sitting next to my wife, and I would be actually reading the book and everything. So what influence did that have on today's sitcoms? I mean, he established a pattern that's used to this day.
Yes. I mean, one of the genius aspects of the three camera technique, which had been pioneered by the game show producer, Ralph Edwards, who was using it to shoot his show Truth or Consequences. But of course, that's not a play like I Love Lucy 24 minute episode is. Shooting multiple cameras at once, close up, long shot, medium shot, especially with comedy, can preserve the action and reaction in one real moment. Because as you know, when motion pictures are shot with a single camera, you have to set up the camera, take a picture of me, then you have to take a picture of you reacting to me, and you have to recreate it and say the lines again, and you lose spontaneity. So one of the things that comedy directors love to this day on sitcoms like Friends or The Big Bang Theory, and Paul Feig, the comedy movie director of movies like Bridesmaids, he likes to shoot with multiple cameras, even though it's harder for the cinematographers to light and shoot. He likes to do that because it preserves the spontaneity and the immediacy of the comedy. And I think there's probably no substitute for the action reaction in one fell swoop.
I just read for Mork and Mindy, they added a fourth camera because Robin Williams wouldn't stay on his marks. So the fourth camera was always on him. And so it became a four camera shoot. Yeah. Gary Marshall did that.
You also think the scope of it, though. I mean, Desi Lu, when you think that RKO bought it and then now it's Paramount. I mean, this was a really big deal. It wasn't just I Love Lucy.
Yes.
Amazing.
Yeah. And the last two shows that Lucy greenlit as head of the company turned out to be Star Trek and Mission Impossible, which are pretty big behemoths.
Pretty phenomenal.
Those are huge franchisings. Well, in our last couple of minutes here, first of all, I want to ask, what's your next project? I mean, you know, I know you just got this one. It's kind of like, well, I just had this baby. What? But I mean, well, you have something.
You're only as good as your last byline. My plan, my hope is to write a biography of Norman Lear and his impact on television in the 1970s with path-breaking shows like All in the Family, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, and so on. And his widow, Lynn, has agreed to give me access to his as yet untapped archive. And I'm very excited about that prospect.
Excellent. And anything else beyond that, or that's going to be your focus right now?
Right now, it's more than 1,000 boxes that I've got to begin looking through. So I think for the moment, that's enough to keep me busy for a while.
Well, in our final minute here, Todd, tell us about how people can find your book, where they can find it. And is there an audiobook version of this yet?
There is an audiobook version of it. It's available on audio and other platforms, and I actually had the good fortune to narrate it myself.
Excellent.
Of course, the best place to buy a book is at your local independent bookseller to support the vital businesses we need in our towns and cities. But it's widely available all over in both ebook and print, and you know, support your local bookseller.
Excellent. We appreciate coming on Art in the Air. Todd Perlman, he's a journalist, author, and of course, the new book, Desi Arnaz, who's the visionary man who really established what we know today as the three-camera shoot. Appreciate you coming on the show and sharing not only your personal journey, but Desi's journey.
So grateful to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much.
This is Clay Jenkinson for Listening to America, and you are listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM and WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome Melody Capote to Art on the Air. Melody is the executive director of the Caribbean Cultural Center African Diaspora Institute. Appointed in 2018, she has been with the organization since 1984. She is an established leader in the arts administration and cultural activism, and is a bold voice in advocating for cultural equity, racial and social justice for African descendant communities. With experience in development, government relations, external affairs, and special events programming, she has supervised and mentored countless individuals who have gone on to pursue careers within nonprofit arts fields and other community-based organizations. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Melody. Very, very wonderful meeting you.
Thank you. Same here. Hola.
Well, we always like to know the background of the people we have on our show. I call it their origin story. So, Melody, tell us how you got from where you were to where you are now.
Oh, boy, what a journey. Well, I am born and raised in East Harlem, Spanish Harlem, what's known as El Barrio, here in New York City. I'm born to Puerto Rican parents. My mother was born and raised in Puerto Rico. My father was of Puerto Rican descent. His parents, having been born in Puerto Rico, moved to New York and had their children here in New York City. Catholic schoolgirl till about the fourth grade, always exposed to music and art and language and food of Puerto Rican people. So it was just, it was our home. It was the brownstone where my grandparents lived. It was the projects, what was then, you know, New York City Housing Authority projects were then kind of moving on up in our family. So weddings were held in our home, wedding receptions were held in our home, because the projects were brand new and were, you know, kind of a big thing from moving from the tenements into the projects. At about the age of 12 or 13, we moved to the Bronx, where is I still call my home. So the Bronx is still home for me. Studied dance for many years. In fact, in my grandparents' living room in East Harlem, in addition to kind of the Puerto Rican traditions of bomba music and salsa music, which wasn't then called salsa, it was mambo music. We had a neighbor who lived down the street. I will never, ever forget him. Miguel Godreau, who actually went on to dance with the Avenelli Company years later. But he was a student. And in my grandmother's way, what we call susu or colecta or bartering, Miguel would come and teach me and my twin cousins ballet in her living room in exchange for a warm meal. And, you know, just kind of, that was the way we learned some ballet, and he was able to assure himself that he had, you know, some good square Puerto Rican meal on a daily basis. So beautiful. When I went to the Bronx, I continued to study dance, never really professionally trained because my parents couldn't afford it. But any opportunity through school or through summer programs to study dance, I did. So the arts was always a part of our home and my life. It was after school, it was weekends, it was summer programs. And so even when I was preparing for college, and all the folks around me kind of saying, you know, dance, you want to study dance as a thing, you know, as a job, like what's a real, you need a real job. And so my mom always encouraged it, but always said, you know, the common sense mom saying, you know, just make sure you're studying something else to fall back on. She came from Puerto Rico with a master's degree in education. So she taught in Puerto Rico, spoke English very well. So when she came to this country, she also taught, but did not stay in the public school systems here. She went on to do other things. But my mom was very matter of fact, very open to not wanting to raise my brother and I as strict as she was raised. And so the fact that we were always looking to do something other than, you know, something else, she encouraged us very much to do so. So my brother went on to study music and be a musician as well, as his other life, but worked as a paramedic on the ambulance. And I went on to study Black and Latino studies, which then, the early 70s, wasn't even a real thing, wasn't a department. These were courses that I took under my liberal arts degree. And the rest is pretty much history. That exposure to African traditions, Afro-Latino arts, Afro-Caribbean tradition really opened my world to kind of seeing the connection I had with others in my community who, you know, when you're young, you're not identifying as being from here or there. We just kind of were kind of different shades of brown in the same spaces. But at that time, my aunt, who was the founder of the center, and my mom were both kind of working on the founding of the institution I presently run. So it just kind of merged and became this extension of the combination of interests that I had.
And it really shows in what you pursue with the center as well. But I just want to ask something about your mother and actually your grandmother. So your mother was like, oh, it's great that you love the arts, but, you know, you need to have something else. But what about your grandmother? What was she encouraging? I mean, did she, how was her support?
My grandmother really was about instilling in, it was four grandchildren, my brother and I, and then the twin girls who I was raised with. And we were all 6 months apart, so it was like, we were all around the same age. My grandmother really pushed for us to appreciate and embrace our tradition. Yeah. So even as, you know, that's the old people's stuff. We didn't want to hear that music or we didn't want to do that thing. And she always found a way of having it present in her home. And so the fact that we wanted to dance or, you know, as I said, she was the one who even encouraged these ballet classes in her living room was her idea. And then I wasn't thinking yet about being, you know, studying dance, but it was something that just by that act absolutely showed that she was open to so many things. The exposure for us to have something other than what we were typically exposed to. And understanding even that sense of bartering and right. neighbors in her building, all the doors were always open. So we were able to always kind of run around to neighbors and do favors or bring something or get something, because it was just kind of the nature of the way that they lived. And, you know, as an extension, the way we lived. So she, at the point where I decided to study dance, I lost my grandmother when I was 6 years old. So she didn't get to see or hear all that I wanted to be when I grew up. But, and this was my father's mother. My mother's mother was not around as often. But she didn't know what we wanted to do with our lives because we were all so young. But really, it just kind of kept the door open for us to do just what she always said, just be a good person. Her words were always in Spanish, like, just be a good person. I just want you to be a good person. And that kind of rings in my head every once in a while when I think even what I call my greatest masterpieces being my own children who are now adults and saying to them, you know, if you weren't my kids and I met you on the street, my God, what good people you are.
And I would like you.
it just kind of reminds me of my grandmother always saying, just be good people and be good to others and be good to each other.
Well, and it really does show that it's almost like when I looked at everything that you do at the center, which I think you have inspired just a lot of this direction. I just view you as like every waking moment, this is what you're thinking of. Like, how can I improve the community? What can I offer? It's just like, it just shows in all the exquisite programming and action you take there. It's just really glorious. And that goes back to like everything you just said in the family.
Well, even like what you did with the firehouse and starting that, the renovation of that you did in there. I mean, that whole community-based thing. And I was reading in your bio about how during COVID you had some initiatives, which was, you know, it's amazing that you made a positive thing out of the COVID crisis there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think none of this gets credited without my acknowledging both the founder, who I said is my biological aunt, Marta Moreno Vega, and my mother, Laura Moreno. They started this. The center started in the basement apartment of our home. And here I came as a college student and would get paid for typing up proposals or, you know, doing little odd jobs until, again, when I found myself in college learning about Black history and Black studies and Latino studies and seeing how it absolutely dovetailed with everything that they were doing in the formation of this organization. While we were not a mom and pop shop, this is certainly like a legacy, a family legacy for me. And so all of the things that we're doing today, all of the things we did, even coming back to East Harlem with having moved to the firehouse, my mom had since passed away, but Marta and I just kind of felt a coming home, right? This was a real homecoming, coming back uptown to El Barrio, to East Harlem. And so the building of this firehouse, when we got the firehouse, it had been decommissioned and shut down for about 18 years. And this became a real labor of love for her, for myself, and those on staff and our board, and even community members who really pushed for us to be kind of the winners of the RFP, because there was a request for proposals about what could we do with this firehouse. And the fact that community members wanted to see a cultural institution that reflected them kind of was like, well, this is easy. This is what we do. But the actual, you know, actually getting the funding and being able to do the renovations on the firehouse were very challenging. But it was a promise we made to the community. And it's just really sometimes surreal to think that we did it. And here we are sitting on 125th Street in this state-of-the-art building.
You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM on WVLP 103.1 FM. It's amazing. And so an important thing which I always appreciate is
is it, and I don't want to say the word wrong, but Sankofa Young Women's Leadership Program and the Artpreneurs. Mm-hmm. I think that that is so vital, and it, can you talk about what that is like, what that program is like in particular?
Sure. Well, I think that for, again, the history of the organization, and we'll be celebrating 50 years next year in 2026. And I've been here like way long time. But we've really been a training ground for particularly young people of color to come through the organization, see themselves in the organization, and learn with us. So, you know, this is a long history of just the way we give back and the way we bring young people in and our elders, so that there's an intergenerational exchange, so that there's
the mentoring,
to learn, to mentor, right? And I always say, not only do I see mentorship being elders mentoring young people, but young people teach us so much,
so right? much.
Especially in a time where all of this technology that's just so easy and at their fingertips, comes a lot easier for them than it does kind of for me, for some of us. So the mentoring and the training and the opportunities that we have been able to offer since the very beginning, I'm seeing now all of, I've got a few young people that grew up with us who are now on my board of directors, right? Are now my bosses, have come back to teach the next generation, have come back to be part of an advisory committee, have come back to help us plan the 50th anniversary, have gray hair now, didn't have gray hair when they were with us back then, right? So they come in with their gray hair, and I'm like, ooh, I remember when. So we have a program now, the Sankofa Young Women's Leadership Program. Sankofa is a term and also a bird that you will see that is looking back. And the concept of Sankofa is you must look back in order to move forward. And so the concept of this particular leadership program is teaching our young women to go back and grab it, go back and grab those traditions, that history, that the spirituality, the food, the language, those things that make us who we are. And if you don't know what those are and you don't have enough of it, how do we then use it to help shape who you are today and who you can be moving forward? The Entrepreneurial Assistance Center that we created for community artists is very much the same thing. We now have an additional space, an annex space about two blocks away, which was born out of the need of artists of color in particular during COVID and at what was kind of this racial reckoning during following the murder of George Floyd, where all of a sudden we were all in this space, in this digital space, right? Many in our community either did not have access to internet because not every community has that facility. In some instances, and this is actually the creation of the program, I felt when I found myself doing all this stuff on Zoom, what about our artists? What about our veteran artists, the more seasoned artists, the older artists? They're probably feeling all kind of challenges in this new, with this new technology and in this new space. And as it turns out, it wasn't just the seasoned artists. It was all artists who were saying, wait a minute, if this is the new way of showing my art or doing what I do, I have questions. And one being, how do I protect my intellectual property? How do I protect, you know, myself in this space? Because we were all real quick to do it, but not thinking about kind of the repercussions.
Right, what it means.
Migrating from real time to the digital platform. And so that immediately caused us, and this is kind of how we roll and how we do, even without funding, we created a training program that we called DEAR, Digital Evolution Artist Retention Program, where we started to train artists on these platforms, on their legal rights, on intellectual property protection, grant writing, because now many of our artists moved away from even kind of this gig economy because everything was shut down. How do you continue to create and do your work? And specifically because of the work of the center, prepare our artists of color to be as good as their counterparts when the doors opened up. And so what we thought was going to be, yeah, maybe 20, 30 artists, you know, will come through. We ended up training over 260 artists in a span of like a year. Just kept coming back for more and coming back for more with more questions and more needs. And one of the biggest needs was space to create, space to be in camaraderie with other artists, space to rehearse, space to present. And so we were able to secure 5,000 square feet with a developer up the street, a new development that was coming up, who had to make a commitment to our city council member that they would make 5,000 square feet available to a not-for-profit organization, and they chose us.
Oh, wonderful. We have now
this artist incubator space where artists are able to come and do their thing.
So let's take a look at your exhibition schedule, which I'm looking at your website even right now, but I want you to discuss it for our radio audience. You know, how many exhibits do you do a year? Do you have multiple layers? And so just tell us about what you're doing in terms of exhibits.
Yeah, our art exhibitions or our exhibitions can be anywhere from 2 to 3 a year. Some are in person, some are on our website, or you'll see links to what we call micro websites to other exhibitions that we host. Presently, though, as we prepare for the 50th next year, we have opened our galleries to what we're calling the Community Archives Open Lab. And what we're doing is encouraging folks to come into the galleries, see old photos, videos, slides. So many young people don't even know what the slides are. They don't know what videos are. Vinyl albums, just kind of taking a look at the 49 years of the center's work. It's not all out. Slowly, we keep rolling out different works and different phases of our work so that the community can help us kind of decide what they'd like to see us highlight in our 50th year. Mm. So we have a very huge following and a very huge section of our work that has focused on spirituality and sacred traditions of African descent or connected to Africa. And so we have over the years really been looked at as experts in this arena. And so that's a very large section of the work that practitioners and traditional leaders have asked us to celebrate. In the summer, on August 10th, if I'm not mistaken, we are celebrating Afri Bembe. Afri meaning African, Bembe is like a jam session. And so Afri Bembe celebrates the creative expressions of people of African descent through music and dance. And we're incorporating it as part of the Harlem Week celebration that happens throughout the month of August. And it's a really great opportunity for us to connect East and West Harlem, because again, we're on the East Side. And so it allows us to come into West Harlem and really use it as an opportunity to highlight artists and performers from, particularly from the East Harlem, South Bronx communities in a stage that's typically known as kind of the Central West Harlem community.
Well, it sounds like a busy place there. About how many people do you have on staff there, full-time, part-time, to make this all operate?
We are a staff of 7 doing the work of about 20 people. If they were here to sit with me, they're like, that's right, she's right. Yeah, we're a staff of 7. We have a few part-timers. We're very fortunate with interns and volunteers. And presently, even as we're speaking on the next floor, the archives lab is open, so folks are coming in. They either come in scheduled for a visit or come in off the street. And we have a few interns and volunteers ready to work with our staff to really give people, we don't rush them through the work. You can't, it's just so much. But there's the kind of very familial feel that we offer folks, from couches to sitting on the floor and looking at posters and the collection. And so, yeah, the staff is tremendous. The staff is just amazing. I have to say that.
Well, great. Well, in our final moments here, we want to give you a chance to tell how people can find you online. And of course, if they're in the city, how do they can locate you in person?
Okay. Well, we are located at 120 East 125th Street. That's 120 East 125th Street between Lexington and Park Avenues. We are in person Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday from 10 a.m. till 6 p.m. Our website is CCC, that's three C's, ADI.org, Caribbean Cultural Center, African Diaspora Institute is the full name. And again, the website is cccadi.org.
And we'll have a link on your picture on our website to take you straight there. Melody Capote, thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air, sharing what a wonderful place that you're at in your own art and creative journey. Thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air.
Yes. I want you to promise to come back, though, okay?
I hope you'll have me back. Yes.
All right. Thank you so much.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art in the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell it to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Dee Dotson, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Media, and to Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Ember Forge Consulting, thoughtful marketing and digital learning built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art in the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or send us information about your arts, arts-related event or exhibit, please email us at AOTA@breck.com. That's AOTA@breck.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart.